You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
For decades, the Navajo Nation has been fighting in court for water. 30% of people on the largest Indian reservation in the country live without running water. The Navajo claims the U.S. government is on the hook to help it access water under a treaty dating back to 1849, which returned the tribe to its ancestral lands and promised to provide them with a, quote, permanent home. And this week, the nation took its case to the Supreme Court, where three liberal justices and conservative Justice Neil Gorsuch seem sympathetic to its claims. Here are Justices Gorsuch and Elena Kagan.
Could I bring a good breach of state contract claim for someone who promised me a permanent home, the right to conduct agriculture and raise animals, if it turns out it's the Sahara Desert?
I don't think you would be able to bring a breach of contract claim.
You don't think that's a breach of good faith and fair dealing?
And I guess I don't understand, if the treaty promises water, where you get the idea that that is unenforceable.
Four of the other conservative justices, including the chief justice, appeared to side with the Biden administration.
Why wasn't the water mentioned, as your argument now is it's necessarily implicit? But the other things were spelled out. Wouldn't you have spelled out the water at the time?
Leaving Justice Amy Coney Barrett as the possible decisive vote in the case.
Joining me is Ezra Rosser, professor of law at the American University Washington College of Law.
It appears that the water situation for the Navajo Nation is really bleak. Almost a third of houses don't have running water. So how bad is it?
It's been bad, and it is bad. I think one of the positives of this case is that it brings some attention to something that doesn't usually get much attention at all. But my view on it, outside of the law, this would not be tolerated for any other group in America. It's just because they're Navajo that we are okay with people living with such lack of basic services.
Does this lawsuit depend on a treaty in 1868?
So it depends how you interpret it. I think one answer would be the treaty sets up land, and under Winters, which is this case that recognized the rights of tribes to water to fulfill the purposes of the reservation, that should be enough. And so there's certainly a claim that the treaty, combined with the Winters doctrine, should provide the tribe a lot more rights than they've been given so far.
So what's the argument of the federal government and the others involved? Why shouldn't they have access to this water?
Well, technically, it's not about access. And even the tribe's position is not about access at this point. I mean, long term, of course, it's about actual water. But at this point, the case is about, is the United States even doing the bare minimum to figure out how much water the tribe should have? And the tribe's position, of course, is no, they haven't done anything. The U.S.'s position is, and I think even reading it fairly to them, it is that we don't have to. It's not a yes, we've done enough. It's that we don't have to do enough, meaning that there's no enforcement that the tribe has to force the United States to deal with and protect the tribe's winter's rights.
In this day and age, that does seem astonishing that the federal government would say that.
I mean, in defense of the federal government position, which, of course, as you know, I wrote a brief on the other side saying that it should be enforceable, but there have been a number of Supreme Court cases that have come out against Indian tribes saying that the United States does not have an enforceable obligation or trust responsibility. And so if you read those in a very broad way, then they might limit the ability of tribes to enforce their rights against the United States.
Tell us briefly what the issue is before the justices.
So the issue is the enforceability of the Winter's rights, I think is a broad way to describe it. So the United States government, because of the conquest of tribes, has long recognized that it has a trust responsibility. And sometimes it's phrased in terms of a guardian-ward relationship. But the United States government, for example, on land, the land is held in trust for the tribes, and both the United States and tribes are the owner of the land. And if you hold something in trust, then you're supposed to have obligations to make sure you live up to the rights of the beneficiary or the party you're supposedly supporting. And so it's the tribe's position that the United States has not been doing that, and that at the very bare minimum, the U.S. has to figure out what the level of water Navajo should have is, and then after that, presumably, take steps to ensure that Navajo does get the water they're entitled to. But so far, and we know this just from things like the Central Arizona Project, the basic position of the federal government has been to give away water to non-Indians and off-reservation communities and do very little to protect tribal water rights.
Looking at the oral arguments, it seems as if there were two camps, the conservatives leaning against the Navajo Nation, the liberals plus Justice Gorsuch leaning for the Navajo Nation, and then Justice Amy Coney Barrett, perhaps the deciding vote.
I mean, I think the challenge on making any of these predictions is that in the recent past, the court has done two very dramatic decisions. So they did McGirt, which came out very in favor of the tribal side on jurisdiction in Oklahoma. And then they came out with another case, Castro Huerta, which did the opposite, very in favor of the state over tribes. One pessimistic read from an Indian side is that there had been a change in the composition of the court, and so the balance swung against Indians. But the more positive from the tribal side is you do see that these are hard cases where conservatives, and it's particularly Gorsuch, of course, but conservatives can see the validity of the tribal argument.
You mentioned Justice Gorsuch, who frequently votes in favor of Native Americans. He focused on the language in the treaty that guaranteed the tribe a permanent homeland. Is it possible to have a permanent home and raise animals without water?
That is the most basic, and this is a little bit maybe not as objective as perhaps we are wanting, but this should be an easy case. Navajos live without nearly the water non-Indian communities have. And we have said that they are supposed to have this reservation land and supposed to be used, among other things, for agricultural purposes, as spelled out in the treaties. And we have not guaranteed or protected their rights to water. So I think Gorsuch is right to think it really should come down to a pretty simple, do we believe in Winters, and is Winters still good law? But there are arguments on the other side that are likely to complicate it, and that is, even if you believe in Winters, can you give a right to enforce Winters? And on that, some of the recent cases, Jicarilla and Navajo Nation 1 and 2, both of those have, even in the face of Navajo Nation, of really bad facts on the federal government, the Supreme Court has come back and said no remedy for the tribe. So in Navajo Nation 1, the Secretary of the Interior had killed a report that was going to release information that the Navajo Nation could use to renegotiate a mining lease. And they killed the report because Peabody Cole hired the best friend of the secretary to lobby him. And that wasn't enough for the Navajo Nation to have a remedy, even though that is a clear breach of the trust responsibility. So the challenge is that Winters is now confronting these sort of anti-Indian cases, the Navajo Nation 1 and Jicarilla. And the court has to figure out, you know, do we mean it when we said tribes should live on these reservations, which is Gorsuch, or do we want to excuse the federal government from obligations?
Yeah, so Chief Justice John Roberts asked, why wasn't the water mentioned in the treaty? And Justice Samuel Alito, he sort of question the real-world impacts of the tribe's claim that it would have negative impacts on the water allocated to the surrounding states? Should that be part of the equation, what happens to the surrounding states, or should it be, you know, what's in the treaty and what the federal government is supposed to do?
Two thoughts. So first, to take a step back, the oral argument did focus a lot on the 1868 treaty, and that's a fair. Navajo Nation has a day that celebrates the treaty. There's a treaty day, right? It's a very important treaty. But it's not limited to that. The reservation is much larger than the original reservation, and it expanded through executive orders and other legislation that pushed the boundaries out to the Colorado River. And those also were only viable if they had access to water. So I think one dangerous thing is to focus too much just on the treaty land, because it's also the whole of the reservation needs water. And presumably when they set up the rest of the reservation, they also, just like in winters, imagined that there would be water to support life on that part of the reservation. So I know the oral argument focused a lot on that, but I think it is bigger than that. On the question of the impacts, formally, of course, and the lawyer for the tribe made this point, formally, the United States is just being asked to account for how much water Navajo has a right to, which formally does not take away any rights from any other non-Indian users. Of course, though, the second thing is once that right becomes quantified, and that right is probably very significant, as we heard from the oral argument, that Navajos use so much less water than off-reservation users, then there'd have to be a question of where does that water come from? And the choice to always prioritize non-Indian water users is one that I hope would be challenged.
What does the federal government expect the Navajo Nation to do?
I think it's hard. Right now, again, the position, though, they just are saying we need to know what we have before we do things, right? So they're not asked the big allocation things. Of course, once they have a right to things, then they can push for more rights tied to those recognition of their allocation. I think one answer, you know, when you think about from the Navajo standpoint, the example that I use is the Central Arizona Project is not something that the rest of the state of Arizona had a right to, but the government decided to support, right? Because they recognize the needs of the lower part of the state. Well, if the needs of the Navajo reservation are recognized, then hopefully U.S. government would come in and say, you know, it matters that this many people don't have access to water and we need to do something on it. So that is different from the legal question. This case will not resolve all those questions, but I would be hopeful that if we recognize the depth of the need and the idea, and this is the part of the case, that the United States will be held accountable for where it doesn't act as a good trustee, then some of the water would eventually flow to Navajo households.
There was attention paid early on in the Biden administration to having a Native American as part of Biden's staff. So it seems odd to me that the federal government is taking this hardline position.
I, too, think that this is sad that the Biden administration is coming out this way. I would have hoped that the Biden administration would have decided this is something that we don't want to argue the strongest version of our possible arguments, right? So their argument right now to me is like, you know, a child that gets caught and says you can't punish me. And that can't be right, right? If you actually mean that this is an obligation, it should have some enforcement attached to the person you owe something to. And the argument they're making is no enforcement. On the other hand, you know, the first part of your question, I just gently push back again. I don't think this is getting anywhere near, or the Biden administration or any administration in recent history has paid much attention to Indians. I mean, there was some attention in COVID when Navajo Nation, in part tied to their lack of water, had some of the highest rates of COVID early on. And people correctly saw it. Well, if you can't wash your hands, you know, that could contribute, et cetera. And if you had the overcrowding on the reservation, that would contribute. But the joke that one of the books that I read said is that there was a big turning point when Costner came out with Dances with Wolves, when suddenly people cared about Indians. I don't see a lot of care. I am a non-Indian, and I get still tons of questions that just show the basic ignorance. My kids are in school, and we teach Indians as if they mattered until 1830, and they don't. And maybe they mattered until the 1880s, but we don't think of them as living people much anymore.
This case was first brought by the Navajo Nation in 2003. How is it still not resolved?
There's a lot of answers to that. I mean, one is the positioning of the case and really what they're asking about in this case, in part, on the treaties was disagreements between the Navajo Nation and the lower court on whether or not the treaties could come in to help rest or ground the trust responsibility claim. And so part of it is just sort of stuff involving legal process. I think the other, and you see this in all the water rights cases, even water rights settlements where tribes, states, and the federal government want a settlement, it is a long, dragged-out process. And I would say it's probably only going to get worse as the new normal, the drought that's affecting the Colorado River, intensifies and people recognize that it's likely to have significant impacts on life in those states.
So do you have any feel for how the argument went at all?
There's some positive. And this is sort of like the Brackeen case, where I liked the fact that all the parties were willing to talk about the treaties. I think the Winters part of the claim is the strongest, and that tying that to the treaties and making sure the justices recognize that enforceability matters if you're actually going to have Winters rights. So I liked that part. I thought that was strong. I thought the liberal justices did a great job undermining the state and the federal claim. So I thought the liberal justices were acting very vocal and pushing their view. And I liked that they were a little bit, this will sound small, but they got into the details a little bit. Not a lot, and they still had some trouble about like amount of water being used. But the fact that they cared about details, to me, suggests that even if the case comes out against Navajo Nation, hopefully it won't be against the Winters right period, right? So the fact that it was focused on details suggests that even a negative turn on the case wouldn't be a total reversal of all precedent.
Thanks so much for being on the Bloomberg Law Show. That's Professor Ezra Rosser of the American University, Washington College of Law.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
A federal judge has tossed the majority of the claims made against J.P. Morgan Chase and Deutsche Bank in a lawsuit by a Jane Doe who alleges the banks participated in Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking scheme. Still, Jane Doe's attorneys call the judge's decision, which allows the case to go forward, a victory. Discovery will proceed as the banks face claims that they knowingly benefited from Epstein's sex trafficking venture. Joining me is Bloomberg legal reporter Ava Benny Morrison, who's been covering all these cases. Ava, before we get to the judge's decision, give us a little background on the lawsuit itself.
So a victim of Jeffrey Epstein filed a proposed class action against J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank late last year. The victim, known only as Jane Doe, is alleging that the banks facilitated Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking by providing him with financial services for many years, allowing him to move around millions of dollars and pay off victims, allegedly, and use it to finance his private jet to fly them around as well.
There was a hearing. The banks asked Judge Jed Rakoff to throw out the suit. Tell us what grounds they asked him to throw it out under.
both banks made motions to dismiss to have the entire lawsuits thrown out, and their claims were a little bit different. Deutsche Bank relied on a settlement agreement that Jane Doe had entered into a few years ago, which was meant to protect some entities and people with ties to Epstein from being sued in the future, and Deutsche Bank said that that extended to them, whereas Jane Doe said no, it didn't, and that wasn't the intention of the settlement at all. JP Morgan, who had Epstein as a client from about 1988 to 2013, said that it made a number of arguments, essentially, in asking for the case to be dismissed. The lawyers for the bank said that Jane Doe hadn't met the legal threshold to show that there was knowledge of sex trafficking that could be imputed to the bank, or that there was sex trafficking at all, sexual abuse, yes, but not trafficking. It also said that the actions of its former executive, Jess Staley, who was very close with Epstein, went to his house, flew on his jet, could not be imputed to the bank because they fell outside the scope of his employment.
And Judge Rakoff actually dismissed a majority of the claims against the bank. Tell us which ones.
Yes, it was a very quick decision. I think, you know, in less than a week, he made a call on what claims would be dismissed and what would proceed. So Judge Rakoff dismissed a majority of the claims that were in Jane Doe's suit against JP Morgan, but he did allow a few key claims under the Trafficking Victims Prevention Act to proceed. And I spoke to a couple of attorneys who deal with human trafficking cases who said that this was a pretty good outcome for the plaintiffs. So the ones that survived were that JP Morgan knowingly benefited from Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking venture, and that it obstructed enforcement of the TVPA. So it delayed charges being pressed against Epstein because it didn't follow proper banking laws and raise red flags about his transactions. And with Deutsche Bank, those two key claims were also allowed to proceed, with a couple of other ones as well about, you know, negligent failure to exercise reasonable care as a banking institution providing non-routine banking.
Did the judge say why he was dismissing certain charges and allowing others to go forward?
No, and that's what we're all waiting for. So he announced his decision yesterday, but he hasn't filed his opinion yet, which will go into, I guess, why he decided to strike some claims and why he decided to keep others.
I'm surprised you don't often hear a plaintiff, because the lawyers for Jane Doe also call this a victory. You don't usually hear a plaintiff calling something a victory when a majority of their claims are being dismissed.
No, but I think a lot of people expected it was going to be a bit of a mixed bag. So there were going to be some claims that survived and some that didn't. And it is a very difficult thing to prove that a business or a company was directly involved and participated in either a sex trafficking or a human trafficking venture. So the fact that they've been able to hold on to some of those key trafficking claims was seen as a victory, like you said, by the plaintiff's lawyers, but also a couple of other legal experts I spoke to yesterday who said that this was pretty positive.
What is the effect of dropping those charges on what will happen at trial, or on the plaintiff's claims for damages?
So the damages will still be decided by a jury, and there's not much difference there from what I understand. A lawyer I spoke to said it still leaves some room for punitive damages to be awarded if it reaches trial. In terms of the differences in claims being dismissed, they now can't argue that JP Morgan knowingly participated in Epstein's sex trafficking venture. So it's all about them making money from his sex trafficking and his crimes. They will still have to zero in on knowledge, show that the bank knew that what Jeffrey Epstein was up to and using his money from, or that they should have known.
So now discovery goes forward. Tell us who's already scheduled for depositions and who's in the offing.
Parallel lawsuit going on at the same time that is sort of intertwined in these other two cases. It's the US Virgin Islands that has sued JP Morgan for also facilitating Epstein's sex trafficking. So these three cases are all very interrelated and they're sharing discovery and depositions. And they've really gone for the top of the JP Morgan hierarchy. So last week we saw the CEO of JP Morgan's Asset and Wealth Management Division, Mary Erdos, deposed. This week, Jess Staley, who's the former executive who's very close with Jeffrey Epstein, is facing a two-day deposition over his ties to Jeffrey Epstein. And there's a number of other former and current executives, senior managers across compliance and the private bank who have to hand over documents as part of the discovery process.
Let's talk a little about Jess Staley, about the bank suit against him, and about those more than 1,200 emails.
So Jess Staley was at JP Morgan for decades, and towards the latter part of his tenure there, he looked after Jeffrey Epstein's accounts and became very, very close to him, was visiting his house and travelling with him. But the depths of that relationship haven't really been revealed until these lawsuits. There's been a lot of sort of scuttlebutt and rumours about how close they were. In these lawsuits, we've read a few of the more than 1,200 emails that were exchanged between Epstein and Staley when he was at the bank. These emails included photographs of young women, references to Disney princesses, which the plaintiffs allege was code for young women, and talks about them meeting after Jeffrey Epstein was released from prison for soliciting a minor for prostitution in Florida in 2008. Initially, JP Morgan had sort of sought to distance itself from Staley's actions, but said that the allegations weren't made out or supported by facts, essentially. And earlier this month, JP Morgan filed its own lawsuit against Staley, saying what he did was disloyal, and if damages are awarded and the allegations by Jane Doe and the USVI are made out, that he should be liable for the damages. It's also going a step further in trying to claw back tens of millions of dollars it paid to Staley when he was an executive at the bank for his period of disloyalty and his faithless service.
Staley has denied involvement in Epstein's sex trafficking. My question is, why wasn't he named as a defendant in these lawsuits?
That's a question that I've asked a number of legal experts, and the answers vary. One answer provided was that he didn't have as deep a pockets as JP Morgan, one of the biggest banks, financial institutions in the country. Another answer was that maybe the plaintiffs just didn't have the evidence or the factual basis to sue him directly for participating and facilitating Jeffrey Epstein's sex trafficking. They might end up with a little bit more material and documentation throughout the discovery process.
Thanks so much, Ava. I know you're keeping track of everything happening in these cases. That's Bloomberg legal reporter Ava Benny Morrison. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. And remember to tune into the Bloomberg Law Show every weeknight at 10 p.m. Wall Street time. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.